At this time, when I look back on my life and my work, I see patterns and connections that were not so clearly visible at an earlier stage of my life. The impact of outside political and social events that I experienced in childhood and as a teenager shaped my connection to history. I was a victim of terror and persecution. My life was deeply affected by historical events. As a witness to terrible events, I early learned that history matters. On the other side, a childhood in which artistic creativity and expressions were cherished, and in which learning was considered not only a practical means of career building, but a means of finding equilibrium and meaning in life, well equipped me for survival as a refugee. The life of learning and thinking would always be connected for me with teaching others and with finding a way of applying what I knew to the problems in society.
That's the introduction to Gerda Lerner's most recent book, Living with History, Making Social Change. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Professor Emerita Gerda Lerner is one of the leading historians in the United States. In her most recent book of essays, she looks back at her entire career and her personal background as a survivor of persecution. She was a founding member of the National Organization for Women and helped to create Women's History Month. She worked at Sarah Lawrence College to establish the first master's degree program in women's studies in the United States, and she developed the first PhD program in women's history here at UW-Madison. She is the author or co-editor of 12 books in women's history. Now in her 80s, she also writes candidly about this new phase of her life in Reflections on Aging, the final essay included in her collection, Living with History, Making Social Change.
Welcome back to University of the Air. It's been a long time.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here again.
In your book, you speak of redefining history. That implies that there's a definition in the first place. What is your history sense that you are redefining?
Well, essentially, there are two kinds of history. There's the history as it's actually lived and remembered by everyone alive. And then there is the academic history, the subject, and that is the interpretation of the past given by succeeding generations of historians who disagree with each other about what the meaning of the events that they're describing was. And that is the part of the history that I was involved in changing, because at the time that I came to the study of history, which was in 1962, they managed to include in all the best schools the story of male achievement, male heroism, male ideas, culture creation by men. And they managed to leave out women entirely, except an occasional woman who created a scandal, or usually of a sexual nature, or women who were troublesome, like, let's say, Joan of Arc.
Definitely troublesome for some French
troublesome
and some English.
For whatever reason. If you were a troublemaker, you might enter history. But in actual fact, we did a study, the women historians, in 1971 or 72, of all the textbooks in American history that were used in colleges in the United States. And we found that the actual mention of women, women were mentioned less than 4.5% of the time. Four. This is half the population of the nation.
And can you talk a little bit, before you get to your interest in feminism and women's studies, can you talk about your background in Austria and how you think that shaped your interest in history?
Well, I was born in a middle-class Jewish family. We were not observant, although my grandmother was observant, and we did keep the high holy days. And it was like an island in a sea of unrest, because before I was 18 years old, the government changed 3 times with new anthem, new flag, new everything, new explanation for the past, you know, and we never left Vienna. We were just in this turmoil. And I got used to the fact that fascism was coming, and Hitler fascism. Hitler was bound to annex Austria on racist grounds, that we were supposed to be the same race as the Germans, which was untrue, too. But we lived in a very insecure society. And in 1934, there was an overthrow of the government, a democratically elected social democratic government in Vienna with parties, and a parliament was overthrown, and a leader, Dollfuss was his name, came to power. And the first thing he did was abolish the parties, abolish parliament, abolish trade unions, abolish voluntary organizations, and establish a sort of a semi-fascist clerical government. And he was, within a year, he was murdered by a group of Nazi Austrians supported and paid for by Germany. And his heir, who was named Kurt von Schuschnigg, came to power and followed in this fascist model, which was very much shaped after Italian fascism. And so it became in the last, these were the years when I was between 14 and 18, and the last 2 of those years, it was only a question of when and how the Nazi fascists would take over Austria. It wasn't a question would they or not. It was clear that they would. And when they did, the takeover was much more thorough and much more cruel and much more advanced than it had ever been in Germany. When Hitler came to power in Germany, he was elected legally in 1933. But when he came to Austria, the Austrian Nazi movement was based on a long history of anti-Semitism in government. Anti-Semitic parties had been in power in Austria for 30, 40 years. It took the Germans 4 years of Nazi rule before they were able to launched the persecution of the Jews on a full scale. They did the same thing inside of 2 days in Vienna after that takeover. So what happened was that we lived through this period where you were a citizen, you had a passport, you had rights, you were in a democratic government. And 3 days later, you were declared to be a vermin, declared to be actually like vermin that was destroying the political body and the soul of the nation, and the only help was to chase all the Jews out. That was the common attitude. And we had, for example, all Jewish employees were fired by the government within 3 weeks of the takeover. Well, that didn't happen for years in Germany. And so we had relatives from Germany who came to visit us and who thought, this is incredible what yours. So we had a very, very sharp transition, which made an enormous impact on me. For example, first of all, they fired all the employees of the government, and they fired all the employees. All the doctors had to resign. Jewish doctors were thrown out. They could not work. And then finally, within 6 months, Jews couldn't do anything except try to emigrate. which was impossible because the rest of the world closed its doors.
Did this apply to as well to half-Jews and people whose grandparents, one grandparent had been Jewish?
No, that did not. And there's a long story about these what are called mixtures. Mixed race, this, you know, the whole thing is a construction. There is no such thing. So for me, the coming of fascism started in 1934 when that government took over. And at that time, I was in a gymnasium, which is like a high school, only much more rigorous. And I got involved in a very minor way, in helping the student underground movement. And my involvement consisted of getting an illegal newspaper and presumably distributing it to somebody else and paying a visit once a week to a family whose father had been in jail and then had deported and that was living on underground help. There were one-year jail sentences on each of these activities, however, so that the fact that they were very minor activities, the risk was major. And I was scared all the time, but I learned that I was less scared when I was in action than when I was doing nothing. And so I persisted in it. And when the Nazis then came, I was, of course, in very dire danger because for the Nazis, these were capital offenses, you know, so it wasn't any joke. And in fact, so my father had the foresight. He was a pharmacist and he had a pharmaceutical business. And he had the foresight in 1933 to build a pharmacy in Liechtenstein, which is a tiny country, at the border of Austria and Switzerland and Germany. And he built it up as a loss. He lost in the business for 5 years, but he had in mind that if ever anything went wrong in Austria, we would be able to get to Liechtenstein. And that, in fact, saved my life and that of my family. When the Nazis came, my father was warned by what we would call a friendly Nazi. That's a person that you've known for a long time, who's known you for a long time. You've been good neighbors and everything else. And then it turns out he's a Nazi, okay? And he has enough conscience to do something for you. And what he did was make a call on the telephone and said to my father, you're on the list to be arrested immediately. Get out of here. And then he hung up. And my father did. And since he had been traveling to Liechtenstein every month, he was on the left. It was a routine thing. Except once he was out, the Nazis wanted him back, and they arrested me and my mother. And his brother's wife, who was a famous star of the Vienna Opera, and was a non-Jew who was married to a Jewish man. And we were held as hostages, essentially. That is, we had no idea why we were being held. We were just stuffed into a jail. And it was only 6 weeks, but the 6 weeks shaped my entire life. Because, number one, I assumed that they would find out about my underground activity. And so I had no reason to believe that I would ever walk out of that jail. I had reason to believe that I would go right straight to a concentration camp, and I believed that.
And you knew about this is when 1938 or so?
Yeah.
And you knew about the concentration camps that early?
Oh, there were concentration camps in Austria.
That were
they were already run by the Nazis in the first 4 weeks. This was in the first 4 weeks. And so I was in a very bad situation in that jail. I thought I was, however, was separated from my mother. I had no idea what they were doing to her. And I was fortunate in being in jail with two members of the Social Democratic Party, two young women whose parents were activists in the trade union movement. and one of whom had been in jail before for illegal activity, who were wonderful to me. And the greatest thing they did after about 3 weeks in jail, this was a regular civil jail still run by the Austrian civil servants, but it was already under Nazi rule, and the Nazis dictated that the Jewish prisoners were to get half the rations that the other prisoners got. And those rations were starvation rations to begin with. And when that happened, these two women with me, without saying anything, they just shared their meal with me. They shared all their meals with me. They went on half rations. And I have never forgotten that. I mean, I couldn't have, in the other words, I learned that you can't make it alone. You've got to have organization. You've got to have people who have principles and who are willing to take a risk, and you have to rely on them, and you have to do the same thing for them.
Can you talk about, you write in your book about when you came to America and started organizing among other mothers, other working women here in this country?
Yeah, well, you see, so when I came in this country, finally, I was really very strongly anti-fascist, what here they call premature anti-fascist. And then I married a man who was even more radical, who was a communist. And I got involved in the trade union activities. We moved to Hollywood, where he made a career as a filmmaker during the war. He was a very famous film editor, and probably everybody has seen his films, among them 12 Angry Men.
It's one of his films.
Yeah, classic.
I have to ask how you got to this country in the first place, though.
Well, that's too long a story.
Skip right over that.
Yeah, we're never going to get to what's happened here, which is the content of the book. So I'm trying to say that I was radical. I was scared. I was terrified. I was courageous. And I was convinced that I had to overcome my fear and do something organized, and I did that from the time that I lived here. And I had two children, and at the time, I was just one of the many women who do work in the neighborhood, a housewife. I was also a writer. But what I learned from that experience was that if you want to get anything done in a community, don't go to the politicians. Don't go to your representative. Go to a busy mother of many children, and she will tell you how to get it and do it and help you do it and get other mothers to help you. The grassroots organizing in the community was done by women, 100%. And the moment the job had any public side to it and a pay and any reward, it was a male job. And so I experienced in many different ways the discrimination against women, the channeling of women into inferior jobs, and also the tremendous potential of women as organizers.
But that had been an issue for you back when you were still in Austria, this discrimination against women?
Yes, my mother was a sort of a proto-feminist. But it was all theory with her. But it was. I was already interested in that issue.
And so when you came to America, to Hollywood,
that crystallized. Well, I mean, I came to America, and I came to America as an immigrant woman with $5 in my pocket. Believe me, it came out of my life. That's what I'm saying in my book, that whatever I did later, which people have praised and admired me for and honored me for, that all comes out of my life. It doesn't come out of some theory. The theory derived from what I knew before I did take the action.
We're going to look more at what Gerda Lerner is famous for doing when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Up until quite recently, history as a profession has spoken in the voice of exclusion, in which a small elite of trained male intellectuals has interpreted the past in its own image and in its own voice. In the short span of 40 years, women scholars have challenged the absurd assumption that one half of humankind should perpetually present its own story of the past as being a universally valid story. All kinds of groups who have been previously denied a past have reclaimed their human heritage, like, for example, people of color, Mexicans, Native Americans. This development has been and is truly a landmark event in world history. We have taken many steps in the direction of democratizing and humanizing the academy. We have shown that the formerly anonymous have voices and can tell their stories. We have unearthed formerly ignored sources and have learned new ways of interpretation. We have created networks, organized conferences, initiated over 60 graduate programs in women's history. It has been a rich experience of sharing knowledge, of inspiring one another, and engaging in sharp and often critical debate. Theory and practice, life and thought have fused. It has been my great privilege to be part of the most exciting intellectual movement of the 20th century.
That's the conclusion of the essay, A Life of Learning, one of the essays in Gerda Lerner's book, Living with History, Making Social Change. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're talking to Gerda Lerner about her life with history. When we last left off, you were a housewife, a radical one, organizing after coming to this country from Austria and escaping persecution. But there's quite a jump between that and becoming a leading historian. Can you say something about, in particular, your experience at Columbia as an older female student trying to carve out this new kind of history?
Yeah. At the time that I entered the study of history in 1962, women over 25 were not visible among the students. And that was simply because most departments wouldn't take them. There was total prejudice against them. And I interviewed various history departments in and around New York. And Columbia was the only one that would take me. And I think the only reason they took me is that I had almost all the research on my dissertation already done. And they made me one great concession, which was very helpful, in that I didn't have to finish all my courses before selecting a dissertation topic. They accepted the research I had done in the topic as my dissertation. And so I was able, without getting any other benefits at all, to finish a master's degree and a PhD in 3 years at Columbia University. Very, very few people have done it, and they have been men.
And what was your dissertation topic?
The Grimke sisters from South Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
famous
we did
case.
A program with you on that topic.
That's right. We had a program on that. Right. So I went into Columbia with this understanding, and the first question I was asked is, what do we call you? And I said, well, what do you call the other students? Well, we call them by their first name. I said, I have a first name. So they were younger. The men were younger than I that was teaching me, and it rattled them greatly. And then, of course, I made a nuisance of myself from their point of view. And that whatever we were doing, I would ask, well, what were the women doing while the men were doing this that you tell us was so important?
Seems a reasonable question to me.
Yeah, which is a very intrusive question, very upsetting question.
The early 60s it would have been. Yes.
And what I learned, of course, is I worked all the time. I already had the goal of changing the traditional approach to history. And so I tried to find a way to do that, and I found that the best way to do that was to use sharply analytic questions, because everybody has to respond to that. And then they would make fun of me. I mean, the faculty, they would sort of encourage the students to make fun of me. Ah, we're going to hear some more about women, that kind of thing. And, of course, if I had been younger, I couldn't have stood this. But since I was a married woman, a happily married woman with grown-up children, and after all, I had lived through the Gestapo, I mean, just didn't bother me very much.
Now, did you at this point start building a coalition of any kind, or were you on your own?
I was totally on my own, totally on my own. And the women, there were very, very few women in the class. Out of 15 people, there might be two or three women. That was odd. Nobody was as old as I was. But after a while, they would sort of say, well, suppose you tell us about women. And I would. I would talk nonstop. And that, after a while, I made a place for myself where they actually realized that I knew something about the subject.
How did you come to create the program at Sarah Lawrence, the first master's degree program in women's studies?
Well, while I was doing this work at Columbia, I was also teaching at the New School, and I was teaching at Long Island University of Brooklyn. And the last year of the 3 years, I had a full-time job. So I was really going, you know, I was making a record for myself. And I think that helped, you know. I impressed them, which is what we were saying. A woman has to be twice as good as the mediocre man that she's replacing, which is, and what we're fighting for is the right of mediocre women to make a living and be honored for it.
Mediocre women.
Mediocre women.
Yeah, to be on par with those mediocre men.
Yeah, right, right, exactly.
You're fighting for equality across the board, right?
Yeah, we tried to, and my approach was that only the best is good enough for women's history, so you have to know everything about traditional history, and then you have to know more. And it was on this ground that I had this job at Long Island University, Brooklyn, which was very inferior. History department wasn't a very good place to teach. And I got a chance to teach for 1 year at Sarah Lawrence. And that year was 1969, so we had two student sit-ins as soon as I appeared on campus.
Coincidentally?
I had nothing to do with it, except I had the leaders of every student organization in my class. And I held classes during the sit-in.
And what were you teaching at this point?
I was teaching American institutions.
And what was your spin that was different from the way it had been done before?
Well, I dealt with labor. I dealt with the poor farmers. I dealt with abolitionism. You know, I dealt with all the great social movements. And I stressed the relevant parts of the Constitution and connected to that. So I made a place for myself at Sarah Lawrence, of where the faculty just divided very strongly against me. I mean, many of the prominent people there are very against me because I essentially supported the student strikes. Although I didn't cancel classes, the students came to I said, let's meet outside of school, and we did. Well, anyway, I was encouraged by the president of Sarah Lawrence to apply for a job there. However, I had tenure at Long Island University because I had published two books and I had a third on the contract. And at Sarah Lawrence, they don't give you tenure until you've been there for 2 years. And so she said to me, you won't have any trouble getting tenure with your record. Well, they denied me tenure.
On the grounds of your being sort of a troublemaker?
Yeah. Yeah. Too radical, you know.
In 1969, 1970.
Yeah, yeah. But I then did get tenure eventually, and I decided to make, while I was there, to start a program on women. And that ran into very interesting development that this was a women's college that had always had some small number of men in the theater and in poetry and writing. Okay. But they were trying, the president who hired me, who asked me to stay, was resigning for retirement, and a new president was coming in from IBM, and he and I were on a collision course because his idea was that he wanted to bring more men to Sarah Lawrence. And in order to do that, he was going to build a gymnasium and a swimming pool, none of which he did. He did build a sort of a coffee shop. That was good. But that's all.
All right. And you were on a collision course with him because he disapproved of your emphasis on women in history.
Yeah. And I got an outside grant from the Rockefeller Foundation that allowed my program to start. And that's what made it possible for me to set up a model program. And I write about that in this book. And this chapter is very interesting because it does tell a little bit of the difficulties that you had to overcome to do this. But it was an extraordinary program, and we had wonderful faculty. And so we did very outstanding work that became nationally known within a year. And one of the features of the program that we developed was that we gave summer institutes, and I had to get the money, the grants. I mean, grant writing was like, I had to do that.
I hate it.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody really enjoys it.
But no. But the money allows you to do all kinds of things.
I mean, with the money, you can do it, and without the money, you can't start it, and I just had to get the money.
Now, we're all used to the idea now of March being Women's History Month, but can you tell us the background for that? Because you were part of that, the formation.
I was not just part of it. It came out of one of my classes. So we did summer institutes. We did a summer institute for 35 high school teachers from all over the country. And they went home, each designing a women's history introduction course that they then were giving. And the historical associations used that as a model, and they did six copies of this summer institute at Stanford and other great places, University of Minnesota. And that's how we spread it. We did it by modeling and copying, sharing. And then one of the great things we did was a summer institute for leaders of women's organizations. And we had 47 women, each of whom was either a president or an educational director of a major women's organization. And we had everything from the Girl Scouts to Alianza Femenil Mexicana. We had different colors, different races, everything. And I had the idea that after the summer institute, they should each take on a small project that they could do in their own classes. And I told them just something simple, you know, like write the history or have a history column in your newspaper or whatever. And they went back to talk to each other, and then they informed me that they had the project, and the project was to make women's history a national event by presidential and congressional proclamation. And I said, you're out of your mind. And they said, not quite. And I said, well, how do you do that? And they said, we have to get the Congress and the president to sign a proclamation every year. And I tried to talk them out of it. And
why did you try to talk them out of it? Just because you thought it was unrealistic and therefore a waste of time?
I thought it was symbolic and it would be impossible to do, et cetera. And then they very politely said to me, Gerda, you turned us on to women's history. Why don't you lead the organizing to us? And so I did. And so they did. And that is how we have Women's History Month. It was proclaimed first by President Carter and every president and Congress since. And it became a national movement. And I'm very proud of that. although I deserve no credit for it, as you can see.
Well, except for the inspiration.
Yeah, inspiration.
How that started.
Right. And then I write in the book in the middle section, I give some examples of the kind of theoretical work I did, but also connected with practical work. One is a workshop on the construction of deviant outgroups, which was my most popular teaching unit, and which I gave on three continents.
And that ties back to your childhood experience of being put in the category of other.
Right.
Yeah.
And essentially the secret of it is that you cannot undo one aspect of the monster of racism, anti-Semitism, class hatred, homophobia. You can't abolish one, because as soon as you abolish one, the next one pops out. You have to abolish them all at once. And I designed a strategy in that workshop that shows you how to can throw sand into the gears and make it harder for people to hold on to those beliefs. And it's been proven a very dynamic thing. And then I have a chapter on an oral history project that I did, which proved that the history that's being told about the origin of the modern women's movement has left out the most important and dynamic group that worked on it, which were the women in the state commissions on the status of women, that were middle-class women. They were not youngsters. They were not students. They were not radicals, but they were feminists. And they distributed the feminist agenda that NOW and other organizations promoted to the mainstream. And this story hasn't been told. And I have their names and their biographies and their story in there.
And I know the most popular part of your book is proving to be surprising to you, the reflections on aging at the end of the book. And we're going to look at that very moving and important section of your book when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Cultural attitudes toward aging need to be changed. Old age is not a catastrophe. Old people are not problems and useless dependents. Old people can contribute much to society through their knowledge and life experience, through volunteer work, through their patience and peacefulness. Old age is not a contagious disease. It is the ripening of the fruit, the preparation for the harshness of winter, when the roots grow and strengthen, a time when leaf mold decays, making a seedbed for the new growth of mushrooms. It is the closing of the circle, the fulfillment of the contract of generations. It needs to be treated with respect and honor.
In her reflections on aging, Gerda Lerner turns her attention, perhaps to some extent at least, away from her long preoccupation with history and feminism to the more recent topic of, I think, almost universal interest, really, which would have to do with aging, something that has fascinated and confounded the generations over the years. When did you start thinking about aging as a topic?
Well, I started thinking about it like almost everybody when I started to have disabilities and almost constant pain. That just has a way of clearing the mind. I mean,
it certainly resets your priorities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was considering at the time whether I should give up my house and garden and move into a retirement community. And then I got a letter from an email from a feminist journal in Austria, and they wanted to do an issue on aging, and they wanted to interview me as the main feature of that issue. And I right away, like I always do, I said no.
Why?
I'm not an expert on aging, I said, like an idiot. I said that, and I felt that. What do I know about aging? I never studied the subject. I'm not a sociologist, etc. But then I started thinking for a moment, and I said, but you're thinking of retiring. How come you're not an expert? And so you see, contrary to my pattern, where the theoretical work in my life has always followed the practical work,
right?
Here, it was the practical work, that the practical necessity, that made me start thinking about aging. So I asked those people, would they send me the questions they want to ask me? And, of course, when I got the questions, they were so interesting to me that I changed my tone and said, yes, I would be happy to be interviewed. And then they sent me the edition in German, okay? This is also interesting because I spent decades learning English as a second language. Here I got this in German. And without thinking about it and having no idea why I was doing it, I translated the article into English.
That is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what are some of the insights that you kind of
some of the insights came from my own experience, and then also the article was written a couple of years after this when I had already moved to a retirement community and I was giving workshops on aging there, and that helped a lot. Well, essentially, I think that aging is the last taboo. It's not aging that's a taboo, it's death. All the other stages of life that we go through, we know we have another chance. If we don't do well with adolescence, we can do better.
When you're in your 20s. Mm-hmm.
But if you don't do well with aging, you're not going to have a good death. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Get it right.
Get it right the first time. And nobody wants to talk about it. And nobody, their literature is very few and far between. So the other part of it is that something weird is happening to us, which hasn't happened since we were babies, and that is that our body is not the same as it has been all the time. And we're used to having this perfect body, and our culture tells us that if we don't have a perfect body, it's our fault. And when you watch the ads, the endless ads for drugs for against aging, they all feature people in their 40s, and they're always couples.
Yes.
And they're smiling because they're taking the right drug.
And they're active.
And they're active. Now, the fact is that the vast majority of people aging over 80 are women, okay? And they're alone. That's not there.
That's a statistical reality.
That's not there, right. So I look at the statistical reality and the stereotypes and how the stereotypes denigrate or make aging to be a deviance, number one, it's your own fault. You probably, whatever you did, you may have
You lived
smoked.
Too long.
You lived too long. You smoked. You didn't exercise enough. You didn't eat the particular drugs they're prescribing, whatever. And people are really missing out on something very important. And I wrote a poem in about the same time, and I have a friend who is a very wonderfully talented nature photographer and photographer, and I gave her this poem, and together we put together the lines of the poem with the pictures, and we call it In Praise of Aging.
And it's beautiful. I know a radio audience can't see it, but it has beautiful photographs of autumn leaves, of snow, of branches juxtaposed with lines from your poem.
Right.
We'll put a link to a website that talks about that.
Yeah, a website. And it is called In Praise of Aging.
Yeah, so what's
and
so praiseworthy about aging?
That's what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. praise.
Yes.
So to me, if you look on aging as the ripening, the process, you are relieved of most of the responsibilities you had before for taking care of the world and changing the world. And unless you have a partner who is ill, then you have to do that, and that's your task while you're aging. But essentially, it can be a time where you're relieved of much responsibility and you have to fill it with new things. And people can fill it either with artistic development, trying something they never did before, or starting to write, or starting to read poetry, or starting to act, or any number of other creative things that they haven't had time for before. And that can be a wonderful way of filling those times, and it proves also that it helps against pain. That if you have some new interest and you put yourself into it, if you live for the moment, you live for the day, each day for the day, enjoy what the day brings, find something that you can remember of that day, that you want to remember of that day, that it isn't just awful. There was a wonderful sunset. There was a great, you know, the air was clear and it was beautiful when I woke up. Whatever it is, a positive outlook that says I can still enjoy things. They're not the same thing as before.
You can enjoy people more, too.
And I can enjoy new people. And I don't have to be afraid that they're going to die on me, because they will. And the whole process of accepting aging is to begin to come to terms with the fact that your own life is coming to an end, too, and that's a good thing. I mean, you wouldn't want to live in a world where everybody is 120 years old. It would be a very hard role to play. So, essentially, if you can change the social construction of aging, the stereotypes, the mythology, and if you also, there's another thing that people who are aging have to do. It's interesting, it's never mentioned. But they're the most flexible people in the world, because you can't make it from one day to the next if you're not flexible. You know, one day your hip hurts and you can't get up and stand on your leg. And the next day you're fine and you can go 10 minutes or in half an hour. And the next day your ankle is very bad and you can't do it. And you got to be flexible. You got to learn to swing with it. It's all right. It doesn't always have to be the same. And the same way, patience has to be developed. And I'm certainly a case of a very impatient person, always. That's always been cited by students, by anyone that worked with me. You would say something to me, and before you got it out of your mouth, I already knew the answer. And I would tell you the answer. That was my big weakness, and I couldn't cure it. Well, I've cured it, because nobody wants to see you while you do this. So I've stopped it. It's possible to stop things that you've done all your life and do better.
In some ways, you develop greater self-discipline is what you're saying.
Right, right. And then also, the other thing that's very, very good about old people, so that they are patient, and I said they're peaceful. By and large, I mean, whatever their philosophy is, most old people are not on the side of solving everything by violence. And they are learning something that is essential to survive age or to make a good age, and that is how to ask for help and accept it. And if they knew nothing else than this, that alone would make aged people essential, because our society, for all its blessings, is a very bad society in regard to the idea that everybody is totally responsible for whatever happens in the world. It's, you've got to handle it, you've got to change, you've got to diet, you've got to eat this and that medicine or medication or whatever. And old people that have struggled with that process and have found that you can ask for help and people are happy to help you. They consider it a privilege to help you. And you can accept help in such a way that it enriches people and not diminishes them. And that's an enormously important lesson to learn for the younger people in our society.
Which is a good reason for young people to hang out with old people and vice versa.
I hope so.
A lot of cross influence there can be a really good thing.
Well, Gerda Lerner, I have to say, I think you have done a great job of modeling old age by publishing a new book, by tackling a new subject, which is aging, and continuing to try to find ways in your writing to reach out to other people. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for asking me. I'm really happy to be on the program.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Thank you.